Thank you. So for those of you who were at the conference 2 weeks ago, you have heard of this advective acoustic cycle on several occasions. And so this kind of instability has received particular attention from the core collapse community in the last 3 years. So I thought you might like to know a little more about the mechanism behind this instability. This is a work which I have done in collaboration with the group of Thomas Janka, my student Pascal Galetti, and Leonard Scheck. And I must admit, most of this work has been encouraged at the beginning by Thomas. So the talk will be as follows. I will summarize the present status of this instability according to what we've heard during the conference, and then recall that this instability is new in astrophysics but not new in physics. In order to get more familiar with instability, this is the main purpose of this talk, I will try to show by simple arguments how to answer to these three basic questions, such as why there must be some advective acoustic coupling, why should this instability be low frequency and low L, and why is it transverse. And then I will conclude on the core collapse problem. But I must say right now that I will focus on simple toy models, so don't expect too much of a direct link to observations or even to accurate numerical models. My talk is really focused on trying to understand the basic features. So during I will focus on the core collapse problem, so I'm not sure if it has any direct relevance to people interested in GRBs. And even in the core collapse problem, we are focusing on the first half of a second after the bounce of the shock. So we are in this phase of stalled accretion shock, where the shock is losing its energy because it dissociates ion into nucleons. It is stalled at about 100 to 200 kilometers from the neutron star, and you have a few tenths of a second where the inner regions are cooled by neutrino cooling and the outer region are heated by some neutrino heating. And so these two regions are separated by what we call the gain radius. And this stalled accretion shock lasts long enough to make to consider this flow as a stationary flow and to make some relevant stability analysis on this flow. If the flow were not stalled, we could not do such a stability analysis because the time scales would be too long. So this is a picture from one simulations of the Gershing group, where you see the same thing, where you see some kind of convective patterns, and the gain radius is this dotted line. So the advective acoustic cycle has been invoked on several controversial issues, like the explosion mechanism of core collapse supernova. It was first found in the numerical simulations of John Blondin in 2003, where the instability was so violent that they addressed the issue whether this could even solve the explosion problem. But they were completely fully aware of the fact that their simulations were too crude, I mean, too simplified in the sense that they were nearly adiabatic, so they could not really answer these questions, but it really opened new perspectives. And so in their first paper, they recognized some vortical acoustic cycle, but then changed their mind in a more recent paper. So it's controversial, at least in this sense. It's also, this mechanism was invoked by the group of Gershing as an answer to the old neutron star kick problem, because this L equal 1 instability is so powerful that it may accelerate the neutron star to very high velocities, up to 1,000 km per second. And it was invoked in the even more controversial mechanism advocated by Adam, where this mechanism is just the first step towards the excitation of gravity waves in the neutron star, which then leak as acoustic waves to feed an explosion. But so I think from these three points of view, it's interesting to try to better understand the basics of this mechanism and whether these large-scale instabilities we see are due to some low-order convection or due to some SASI instability, as John calls it, which can be some vertical acoustic instability or some purely acoustic instability, as he advocated in his last paper, or, as I will advocate it, some advective acoustic cycle. So let's try to clarify this. I will be as slow as possible to allow you to interrupt me if ever I'm not clear. Before I go in the details of the advective acoustic cycle, I would like to quickly recall the following result, which is that the classical picture of convection, which is described by Chandrasekhar, resembles the convective patterns of this gain region, because the gain region is heated by neutrinos, so there is an anthropic gradient which increases downwards. So you indeed have anthropic gradient and gravity, like in this convectively unstable layer of a star. But I would like to stress the fact that these two things are not the same, because here you have a flow with a shock wave, and matter spends only a limited amount of time in this gain region, whereas here we have a hydrostatic equilibrium where matter has plenty of time to wait for convection to be effective. So you must really be careful when you invoke some convective mechanism. You must be careful that the time scale of buoyancy must be short compared to the time scale of advection through this unstable layer. We have shown with the Gershing group, but using very simple toy model, that when you compare these two timescales, so which basically it's this parameter chi, which compares the timescale of buoyancy and the timescale of advection, if the ratio of these two timescales is smaller than the threshold, which is 3, the buoyancy is simply inefficient in driving convection, and the flow is stable. So you can have negative entropy gradient and full linear stability. That's a very important point to remember. Apart from that, if the advection timescale is long enough, convection happens normally. But this is a subtlety which is useful to know.
Is that true for all wave numbers, though?
Yes. So that's
your HKX.
Yes. Actually,
this is like a Rayleigh-Taylor stabilization with a moving front.
Exactly. Except that it's stabilization at both short and long wavelengths. We are used to Rayleigh-Taylor being stabilized in ablative fronts in inertial fusion. But this is a stabilization at a short wavelength on this side, so you have this cut. But here you see a stabilization at low wavelength too. So you have both a minimum and a maximum wave number, which scale like this ratio of time scales. So it's more than the inertial fusion thing, and that's important in our discussion, because this low wave number stabilization is going to be important, because L equal one is always is always unstable. L equal one is less unstable than the L corresponding to the scale, but it is always unstable in the Chandrasekhar picture, whereas with advection, the low L's are simply stabilized much earlier than the others. And doing estimates, you find that L equal 1 in this picture is stable with respect to convection. It can be unstable by some nonlinear something, but linearly, L equal 1 is stable in this picture.
But is that because of H over R being small?
Even, no, but even with H over R being 1 half, yeah, or 1 or 2 thirds, L equal 1 will have... I agree that if H over R, if the gain radius is very small, then L equal 1 will be unstable again. But if H over R is like what we see in those pictures, in those Corcoran pictures, it will be stable linearly. So, you know, there is this picture of Errant where you have big convective cell merging into larger cells. This is a difficult case to disentangle because once the bubble has inflated to large scale and the gain radius remains small, then indeed you have a large gain region compared to the gain radius, a large shock radius compared to the gain radius. So then you can accept that L equal 1 is unstable, but it is not unstable from the beginning.
Okay, so some of this then depends. This is one of the things that we disagree with in the Corcoran community is actually the entropy profile right after bounds. And my fear that, and so if the entropy profile is very, very sharp, you know, very deep entropy profile, then I would expect to get bubbles rising fairly quickly, and it seems like then I would quickly get where my gain region is very small compared to the convective region. And that isn't it's not driven by heating, neutrino heating, it's just the shock has a very big entropy gradient at the beginning.
The deceleration of the shock, you mean? Due to the deceleration of the shock?
Yeah, due to the deceleration of the shock.
So that's possible, yeah.
So I'll tell you the difference is that depending on which equation of state you use, the one I use makes a very big entropy gradient. The one that Thomas and Adam use makes a very shallow gradient. At some point I was hoping that it didn't matter. I mean, that's their assumption, is that the equation of state doesn't matter, because we found a bug in the one that they're using, so they say it doesn't matter. But now it seems like if the initial conditions matter, then I start worrying about this equation of state bug that Adam and Thomas have in their codes.
So this is a different issue of this first, this is a transient. So Thomas say that this is a transient phenomenon, that this initial entropy gradient is going to lead to some turnover and then be forgotten. So this is a different, but I'm just making a point on the general argument about negative entropy gradient in a stationary flow. So this is a more basic point. But this is not the subject of my talk.
Well, I had one more little thing with this, though. But like Adam showed that, you know, in his case, the core was actually bouncing up and down, so the inner boundary may not be fixed. Would that make a difference?
No. In this convection problem, no. Because this calculation deals only with the gain region. You're not relying on some feedback from the inner, from the neutron star. You're not relying on any acoustic waves. In discussing convection here, you're isolating this convective region and have a leaking boundary. So let's try to go forward. So the work of John showed some instability, which you may have seen it in this 2D simulation. So there are two papers in 2003 and 2005, and I understand that John wished to come back to this first paper because he made some misinterpretation, in particular when he showed this advection of vorticity and acoustic feedback. It's true that the time scale of this advection here is a long time scale, and you can see on this plot of the acoustic feedback that you have many lines. So these two phenomena are you cannot relate them directly. You should on this plot you should only look at the low frequency acoustic feedback and not be influenced by all these high frequency lines. So this plot in a sense is misleading because it involves some high frequency acoustic sound which is not related to the downflows or to the advected vorticity. So this is an important point which John corrects in his 2005 paper. But then he takes the extreme opposite view of saying, I was wrong to advocate a vertical acoustic cycle, and it is a purely acoustic thing, a large-scale, unstable acoustic mode. Unfortunately, it doesn't give a physical explanation for this, at least not a conclusive physical explanation for this large-scale, unstable acoustic mode. And to me, the question is still open. And the fact that he does not recognize the advective acoustic cycle in these simulations, to me, is simply that he needs to analyze it in more details, and we are working together to try to get the answer. One difficulty in this particular simulation is that the two time scales are very similar. I mean, if you had a vertical acoustic cycle, it would require advection of vorticity down to this kind of radius here, where you see this particular thing, and then a feedback. It's not a cycle where vorticity is advective down to the neutron star, but it's advective down to a certain effective coupling radius, which is about here. And the time scale for advection down to here plus feedback is about the same as the acoustic time scale of the lowest order acoustic mode. So from the point of view of time scales, you cannot disentangle the two modes, and that's why it's so difficult to conclude. One good thing is that if you do the linear stability analysis of this flow, because I should remind you that it is a stationary flow, John considers, it's not a collapsing core. So it's a stationary flow with a shock. You can make a stability analysis. The radial part of this stability analysis had been done by Hook and Chevalier in 92. And my student, Pascal Galetti, did this calculation for non-radial modes. And he finds both the radial and the non-radial eigenvalues of this flow are in agreement with the growth rate that John obtained in his numerical simulations. So there is no big concerns about whether the simulation is correct or not. Everybody is happy with the result. It's the only question is about understanding the mechanism behind it. So once again, I like to stress that determining eigenfrequencies is not enough to tell you what the mechanism is.
Roughly, what is the imaginary part of the frequency divided by the real part?
The imaginary divided by real? I mean, the growth rate divided by oscillation, or the
opposite? Yeah, roughly.
It's a factor 10. But yeah, it's a factor.
And what is it? And then, what is the oscillation period just in seconds as an estimate?
It's 20 milliseconds. So
that's 20 millisecond growth rate or oscillation rate?
Oscillation.
Okay.
Growth is
slower, yeah.
Right. Yeah. When I say factor 10, it can be less than factor 10. Yeah. Less than a factor 10. So let's remind you that there is some literature outside astrophysics that I invite you to look at. So like some journals like Journal of Sound and Vibration or Combustion Science and Technology or the Journal of Acoustic Society of America or whatever, these journals are full of examples where you meet such instabilities. Like in the 1965, to analyze the whistling kettle, you have these two rings here where when the air is hot enough to flow rapidly, it produces a shear layer, and these vortices are passing through the second ring And by passing through the second ring, it produces an acoustic feedback, which then triggers the formation of new vortices at a fixed frequency. And this gives the whistle. And also in a very similar instability is in the Ariane 5, you have vibrations due to a similar instability due to the segmented solid propagule. And also in ramjets, you have a similar instability, this time between the combustion zone and the nozzle, it's a 1D instability without vorticity. It's just entropy perturbation, which are advected. So acoustic wave perturbed combustion produces pockets of gas which is not properly burnt, and then when it passes through the nozzle, it produces a feedback. So these are well-known processes. In an astrophysical context, I have investigated these kind of instabilities on the problem of Bondi Hoyle-Littleton accretion, where you have a black hole moving at supersonic velocity in a uniform gas. And then so you have a stationary flow, which Bondi Hoyle and Littleton thought of. Between the shock wave and the accretor, you have a stationary flow. But people who did numerical simulations found that this flow is not stationary, but unstable. And in order to understand this instability, I got interested in the behavior of vortices and acoustic waves in this region. And to analyze this flow, since the shape is too complicated, I analyzed this inner region, this front region, and thought that this front region would not be far from being purely radial. So that's why I analyzed the instability of a radial inflow. So I took the Bondi solution and cut it at some point where it is matched to a supersonic flow. So there is a shock. There is one position of the shock where you can make this matching to obtain a stationary flow where matter is flowing supersonically and then decelerates and then accelerates again to fall into the black hole. And by
this is a perfect fluid, and with what gamma?
Constant. Any gamma constant between 1 and 5/3. And by doing this analysis, I analyzed in detail what happens when the pressure wave meets the shock. It produces entropy and vorticity perturbation, and when advected downward, they produce some acoustic feedback. So this was analyzed in those papers. And it was a surprise because I didn't expect such an efficient instability. So, and to tell you the kind of analysis you can do to really make sure of what the instability mechanism is, you can compute in detail. This is a bit tedious, but it's, to my knowledge, the only way to be sure of what you're doing. So you can compute what happens when a pressure wave meets the shock, what amount of entropy and vorticity is produced, so compute some efficiency Q at the shock, and then when this entropy falls down in the accretion flow, what amount of pressure is going to be produced by this efficiency Q nabla for these gradients, and then multiply these two efficiencies and check whether it's bigger or smaller than one. You can do the same with purely acoustic wave. So this formalism has been developed in this paper. Why the dispersion relation you obtain is a bit complicated, because you not only have the advective acoustic cycle, but you also have the contribution of the purely acoustic cycle. So this is a bit complicated, but you should believe me that it's worth the effort to be sure of what the result is. I don't want to go into the details of what's happening in this black hole accretion. I will now go to a similar setup, but where we have a decelerated accretion flow, which mimics core collapse accretion. So,
can I ask a question, though? That I asked in Adam's talk, and he sort of blew me off in the answer, and then wasn't available afterwards. so I got exercised about it, went back and did a calculation of the back of an envelope, which is a viscosity. Now, he said it's all taken care of, at least the bulk viscosity part. I went out to some mythical region, which was a mixture of protons and neutrons and helium only, right?
I think I know what you're going to say, and I think I propose that we postpone this discussion to the questions, because your question is about damping by viscosity, and all
well,
my talk.
I was going to ask, the short form of my question: do you put viscosity?
My answer is no, but it's an important thing to discuss. But all my talk is in viscid, so.
But
I'm running out of time.
but there is a certain disjunction. I think I could be wrong about this, but I will try to point it out, between what we saw in Blondin's talk, which was beautifully in the style of yours in showing what was happening over time in detail, and Adam's, where he showed this bunch of stuff. In Adam's talk, you couldn't really tell, I couldn't really tell what was acoustic. And so, given the fact that in the real world, with all this junk and a more complicated equation state and something that doesn't react instantaneously in time,
could you postpone?
Yes, I think it's better.
I want to make the point, and that is that it wasn't clear to me that there was any connection really between the Blondin result and what you supposedly found in the simulation.
Okay, I will address this specific point at the end of the talk. So, if you want to get some hand-waving arguments about why should there be a coupling between advected perturbations and acoustic perturbations, then I'm going to hand-wave. There is a simple way to look at it, is there are two ways, two kinds of advected perturbations, entropy perturbation and vorticity perturbations. And these two kinds can be treated separately because the argument is not the same. So for entropy, you don't need 2D, you take a 1D flow. And so like an accelerated flow through a nozzle, which you can integrate in the transverse direction. When the flow passes through the nozzle, it is heated adiabatically. So the temperature is not the same here and here. And in an adiabatic flow, entropy is conserved. So the entropy perturbation is the same here and when it is here. But the energy carried by this perturbation is not the same. The energy carried by the perturbation depends on temperature. So you can simply make a global argument and measuring the energy of the perturbation here, measuring the energy of the perturbation here, and the only way in this simplified context, the only way by which the energy can change is by acoustic emission. So you can directly measure that the amount of energy, of acoustic energy produced is directly related to the difference of energy, which is directly related to the difference of temperature or enthalpy. You can, so this was not hand waving. This was an exact calculation, but you can also make a hand waving argument by thinking that entropy is the way by which pressure is related to volume for a certain volume of gas. And by changing, so this region has a slightly different entropy. When it passes through this nozzle, the way it adjusts its volume to the surrounding pressure is not exactly the same as the material around it. And being different, it's going to push the material around it and generate acoustic waves. So this was the hand-waving argument. Concerning vorticity, why should vorticity be coupled? Because of course, you all know that vorticity and entropy are completely decoupled, completely independent of pressure waves in a uniform flow. This is the starting point. So any coupling will come from inhomogeneities. And if you try to, if you imagine an accretion flow onto a hard surface, slowly settling down, and if so, these lines are lines of equal mass. Thing is being is settling down. If you imagine a vorticity perturbation on top of this slowly settling down flow, you can, and let's imagine it's isothermal, you can convince yourself that you cannot make a vorticity perturbation without without breaking the pressure equilibrium. You can just look at it a long time, long enough, you will see that by lifting up some material, you will bring together regions of different pressure. But this is also hand waving.
Can I just say briefly, so the argument of energy is interesting, but what I don't see is how you can really distinguish that it goes into acoustic energy versus deceleration of the surrounding fluid elements, reducing kinetic energy. PdV work on the surrounding material, which decelerates surrounding material, so sort of a hydrostatic response versus an acoustic response. Is that the frequency sound argument that your flow is supersonic or?
Yeah, PdV, I think you get rid of by dealing with the
because you're dealing with entropy.
You see
what I'm asking? It seems to me there's different forms in which the energy can be.
No, it's true. This is a very dangerous. It turns out to be true, but it is a dangerous argument, which you could not even do if there was some viscosity somewhere which could get rid of energy. And here, it turns out to be the only way. So. Now, for people who don't like hand-waving arguments, there is a simulation to show you how things are coupled. And before showing you this simulation, I'd like to introduce it to you. So this is the simplest setup which I have imagined to couple vorticity and entropy to acoustic waves. So I take a uniform flow, uniform except... So the potential, I take an external gravitational potential, which is uniform, except in a small region where there is some gravitational force. So the potential is like a step function, a smooth step function. It would be a step function if this region was of size zero. And I can consider a stationary flow, a 2D stationary flow, parallel, Cartesian, in this geometry, coming from the top. It comes in with a certain Mach number and comes out with a different Mach number because it's been decelerated or accelerated by this gravity here. So this is a toy model. And then on this stationary flow, I let some vorticity be advected with the flow. And in all my plots, when I draw vorticity or even entropy, I draw this kind of arrow. But you shouldn't be confused. I'm only dealing in the Fourier space, so it's actually a shear wave. When I'm saying vorticity, it's a shear wave. So you imagine a shear wave with a certain horizontal wave number. You have some vorticity coming down. When the vorticity is accelerated or decelerated, it's going to produce acoustic waves, and then vorticity continues its way. So acoustic waves are going to be produced upstream and downstream. So this is very simple, and I will show you how it looks like in real life of simulations. And the good thing about this toy model is that it's going to stress one very important point, which is time scale, which is the frequency of acoustic waves. Because when I set up this problem, I decide what is my horizontal wave number, and I decide at which frequency I shake my vorticity wave. So if I choose a high frequency acoustic wave, a high frequency shear wave is going to produce high frequency acoustic waves. If I produce a low frequency here, if I take a low frequency shear wave, it will produce low frequency acoustic waves. But if you remember the dispersion relation of acoustic waves, everybody knows this kind of dispersion relation. If you have specified the horizontal wave number and you have specified the frequency, you haven't much freedom. The vertical structure of the acoustic wave you produce is going to be directly related to your input parameters. And if the frequency of your input parameter is low enough, the acoustic wave you're going to produce is going to be evanescent. This is a very important point which many people just simply are not aware of, especially referees. And it's basic and important. And this argument is made without advection. And please trust me, once you have advection, there is a factor Mach number which enters this game. So if the frequency is larger than this threshold, you produce propagating wave, and if the frequency is lower than this threshold, you produce evanescent waves. So is it clear? Now I'm going to show you how it looks like. Unfortunately, I'm not a numerical person, so the only numerical code I have is an isothermal code, but you can do this in an isothermal code. Which is the code which Frédéric Massé lent to me nicely. So, where are my windows? Oops. Okay. So I hope I'm not lost. So let's focus on this first plot. On the right, you will have a vorticity wave coming from the top. The region where the flow is decelerated, actually in this case it is accelerated. In this case it goes from Mach 0.1 to Mach 0.7. So this thin region here is the region where the gradient happens, this region here. And this plot shows vorticity and this plot shows pressure. It's a simultaneous movie, two screens. And you will see the shear wave coming down, and when it reaches, so I think it speaks for itself. Is it clear? You see, I do it again. You see the pressure wave, you see the pressure feedback being produced exactly at the point where the shear wave meets the inhomogeneity, and then you have a stationary flow where the shear wave continues to go down and the pressure wave continues to be produced. But here you see it's an evanescent pressure wave because I have considered this a low frequency shear wave. Tell me, this is, if you don't accept this, then we must do it again. Sorry? This is vorticity, and this is pressure. So another example is just the opposite, where I start with Mach 0.7, fast, so that's why it goes fast, and then Mach 0.1. And then you will see it will produce propagating waves. But just due to the choice of frequency, you can play with it with any parameter. So this is the acoustic wave which is produced, and there is a very small, very weak, evanescent pressure wave produced in the region below.
I mean, it looks like your acoustic wave is trapped at the boundary and is propagating to the left, and it has an evanescent tail above and below. Is that correct?
So
it actually looks like you have a wave that's trapped in the boundary.
This one?
No, no, no. At the boundary, you have a finite thickness boundary. Your transition is finite.
Yes, finite.
Right. So it looks. What I'm asking is.
Oh no no no.
Track
no,
wave in the boundary.
No no no. It's the. It's not. The boundary is very small compared to the.
Yeah. But it looks like there's a wave traveling to the left in the boundary.
Everything is traveling to the left because I have chosen a certain kx. Yeah. I don't think there is a mean to trap something, but...
But it's a finite thickness boundary, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and, yeah. So let's go back to the... What is it? So the interesting thing here is that even in an isothermal flow, the threshold, this threshold, which we all agree on, is different, depends on the Mach number, so it can be a different threshold in the upstream and in the downstream region. So that you can find a case, as I showed you, where the wave is propagating in the upper region and evanescent in the lower regions. You see, just because these two thresholds are not the same, well, they depend on the Mach number.
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking is that this is almost as if you have just a gradient in the sound speed. I mean, a lot of the phenomena looks a lot like what you have if you just
Indeed.
Have a sound speed change, but no flow, right? Because your Mach number is an effective correction of the sound speed.
So,
it doesn't matter.
You know, in the isothermal case I showed, sound speed is uniform.
Right.
Okay.
But the Mach number condition looks a lot like what you would have if you just had Snell's law in a medium with a changing sound speed. Your Mach number is an effective sound speed modification.
Okay. Right? I don't know. Maybe you can...
In the application, the sound speed varies greatly over the wavelength of the disturbance, doesn't it?
No.
Okay.
Oh. Yes. The wavelength, this region is small compared to the wavelength.
Yeah, sure.
That's what you, yeah. Okay. Now, the example we've just seen can be analyzed quantitatively and with simple algebraic formula in the limit of a thin coupling region. So this is called the compact approximation. In the limit of a thin compact region, then you can compute this efficiency as an algebraic formula, which depends on this parameter mu, which involves this threshold between propagation and evanescence. So you will see this parameter mu everywhere in my calculations. And when you compute this efficiency, you obtain this formula where you can recognize some contribution due to the gradient, due to the increase of enthalpy. You remember this this hand-waving argument I had about temperature increase, so you recover this here. But you also, since it's a 2D calculation, you also have some contribution for transverse perturbations. And in order to check the validity of this compact approximation, I did this calculation by integrating the differential equation through this inhomogeneity, and computed in red the real coupling efficiency, and in black my analytical formula. And you find what you expect is that at low frequency the two agree, and at high frequency there is a cutoff. It means, as in a sense, that's how I understood what you said. When you have acoustic reflection at very high frequency, if the wavelength is smaller than the gradients, then you don't have any more reflection, you have a cutoff. Here it's similar, but remember, you don't send acoustic waves, but you send vortices. And so you have a cutoff, and the cutoff is cutoff frequency is related to the time scale of advection through the region of gradient, which sounds reasonable. But so the bottom line of this calculation is not only you have some analytical estimate which can guide your calculation, but also you have established that there is a cutoff frequency above which the coupling disappears, and this cutoff frequency is directly related to the time you spent in the coupling region. Good. Now you can build the simplest ever example of advective acoustic instability. Now, before we were just discussing with some coupling, but now we are putting as an upper boundary, we are putting a stationary shock, and now the feedback is being trapped by the shock because the feedback is going to produce new entropy perturbation and new acoustic waves. So the coupling here have been studied before. We have some analytical estimates. The coupling at the shock are well known. You can find them in Landau, in the hydro book of Landau Lifshitz. So it's a straightforward thing to multiply this by this and obtain the global efficiency of the cycle. It's an ugly formula, but it's an algebraic formula. You can plug it in your computer. You have the same for refraction for the acoustic cycle. So you can immediately compute the eigenmodes of this toy model without any differential equation, at least in the limit of a thin coupling region. And so here, I plot the eigenmodes, so it's the real part and the imaginary part of the eigenmodes, and the different points are different order n. So I have considered a box with a certain size, and so my box is four times. I didn't write it, but the box is four times in length this distance. Everything is normalized to this distance, and I consider a jump here, which produces an increase of temperature by a factor 0.75. So it's not a gigantic increase. So in this example, the radial mode is stable, the n equal 1 is unstable, etc. And you have an infinite number of different modes which are unstable. But this is with an infinitely thin layer. But since you understood what was before, you now guess that once you take into account the finite width of the layer, all the modes with a frequency higher than the cutoff are going to drop down. So that's what happened. So this was with a zero thickness, and now I do the same with a coupling layer of thickness 10% of the distance of the shock, and you see all the high frequency mode drop down. So here, as a function for this particular example, as a function of the coupling thickness of the coupling region, I plot the growth rates. So all these growth, and this is no longer the result of a compact approximation. This is the result of a numerical integration. You go continuously from the compact approximation at infinity on this side to any value of the coupling region, of the size of the coupling region. So by doing this, you can check that the compact approximation is correct, because you can check that all these numbers here are exactly the same numbers on the left side of this plot. And you can produce, for example, if you say the thickness is 0.1, you can produce this eigenspectrum where the dominated by n equal 1 and then n equal 4, etc. So, and you understand what has happened, because the existence of a cutoff frequency due to the finite thickness of the coupling region sets a cutoff frequency, so you are limited to low frequency perturbations, and the condition of propagation for acoustic waves favors low wave numbers. You remember this condition, because if you violate this equation, the coupling will be strong, but the feedback will be evanescent. So you will have a strong coupling, but it will not reach the shock. So the condition of evanescence is responsible for having a low order instability, and the existence of the finite size is responsible for having a low frequency instability. So this is the most important plot slide of my talk. So if you can ask question on this one, because these two arguments are really the main information I would like to transmit to you, is that the advective acoustic instability is a low frequency, low order instability simply because of these two arguments: the existence of a finite size of the coupling region, and you don't want evanescent waves to produce an efficient feedback. I mean, evanescent waves are just inefficient; they won't reach the shock. So you're limited to high frequencies, higher than the value of Kx. Are there any questions about that, or are you lost? It's okay. Yeah. So this is the main point. Then you can ask at a higher degree of sophistication. But if you look at this equation, then you would think that n equals zero, like k equals zero, satisfies this condition. So the purely radial mode or longitudinal mode should be quite efficiently coupled in the coupling region. So why should n equal one be better than n equal zero? And why is it so irregular? Why do you have such a mess? Why don't you have a smooth behavior? And these two questions can be addressed quickly, but...
Sorry, I do want to ask a question. So, again, if I try to map this to Rayleigh-Taylor, it looks to me as if it's Rayleigh-Taylor due to gradient stabilization. So the high wave numbers are stabilized.
Here, there is no Rayleigh-Taylor.
No, I know. But I'm just trying to. What I want to really be sure I understand is what stabilizes the high wave numbers, the high k. And you're saying it's because that's set by the finite thickness of
yes.
the transition.
Yes.
Right. And if the transition's infinitely thin, then all wave numbers are
unstable. And Rayleigh-Taylor is the same. Yes.
Yeah. Right. So what I want to always understand is why L equals 10 doesn't grow faster than L equals 2. And you're saying it's because the thickness of the transition region is finite.
Yes.
That's the highest wave number that
yes.
you want stable. Okay, that's great.
It's exactly the same argument for Rayleigh-Taylor.
Yeah. Great.
Good. So why n equals zero are less favored than n equal? Because here, yes, I should say, here I gave an example which is nearly random. I chose parameters. I promise I didn't make a big effort to choose these parameters. The only thing I did is I chose this temperature ratio so that L equals zero, n equals zero is stable, because I wanted an example which is stable in 1D, because this is meant to be a benchmark test which I have proposed to John Blondin, and he will try to see what kind of numerical resolution is needed to reproduce this, because this is also an important issue. How far are our numerical codes able to handle these kind of instabilities? This is not very clear, because of numerical viscosity, vorticity waves are very often damped by numerical viscosity. So in such an example, it's quite interesting, because if you choose, for example, if you choose the width of the coupling layer here, like 0.4, you should be dominated by a structure with n equal 4, and if you move slightly to a larger coupling region, then you only the n equal 1 should dominate. So you can really make a numerical test easily. In a second step, you can really measure the growth rate, but in the first test, you can really look at the shape of the structure. And I wanted a test which would be stable in 1D. But if you make a slightly stronger temperature step or gravity step, you destabilize also the L equals zero. But I must say that N equals zero is always less stable than the L equal one.
Sorry, I'm still trying to understand this. But so, and if you change gamma, it doesn't matter at all. From 5/3 to say close to 1, so you're going from close to isothermal.
So yeah, isothermal will make a change. Yeah, there is something complicated about the iso. I mean, all these formalism, all these formulas are valid. Even the global coupling efficiency, you can take the isothermal limit. The formula is correct. But there is something which is still a subject of investigation for me, is to understand why the isothermal case is always stable when decelerated. If you take this toy model with a deceleration and an isothermal flow, it is stable. And if you take this toy model with an acceleration, isothermal flow, it is unstable. So there is something I don't see the fundamental reason why a decelerated isothermal flow should always be stable.
Your temperature in this whole region is completely constant, right?
Temperature here?
Yeah.
Yes.
Constant.
Yes, apart from perturbations. Yeah.
Suppose there's a gradient. Does that matter?
No. It's if you have a gradient, this is a gradient, so.
Yeah.
A gradient, but a gradient will start to play a role in coupling pressure and advected perturbations if they have a wavelength larger than the scale of the gradient. That's the way to look at it. So as long as your gradients are smooth, you can ignore them. And so all this discussion of the cutoff frequency, etc. Deals with the presence of gradients. So the coupling is what I say is that the coupling is negligible as long as the time scale to go through the scale of the gradients is short, is long compared to the time scale of the wave. Just comparing the time scale of the wave and the time scale to go across the gradients. So, and if I have time at the end, I can show you a simulation of this instability, of this global instability, but in the unstable case, which means accelerated flow. So here the L equals zero mode is stable, so you can have a hint of this contribution of vorticity of transverse perturbations in the efficiency, but it's slightly more complicated because the Kx is in all these mu numbers, so the formula is more complicated to analyze. And actually, you find out that the efficiency of coupling at the shock, so this Q shock, the value of the coupling at the shock, is the one which is really playing an important role in deciding where this efficiency is highest. And actually, the efficiency of coupling is corresponds to this, depends on the incident Mach number M1, so the Mach number before the shock, and corresponds to acoustic waves which are closed, so this is supposedly small, so it corresponds to acoustic waves which are close to evanescent, so it's at the threshold between propagating and evanescent waves, so these are very transverse waves. And I'm nearly finished. Now, if you want to understand why is it so messy, why is the distribution of growth rate so irregular, then you have to go back to this paper I wrote in 2002, where I analyze the effect of the contribution of the acoustic cycle, because the acoustic cycle can be either the contribution of the acoustic cycle can be either constructive or destructive compared to the so you have this advective acoustic cycle which is the dominant engine of the instability, but at the same time you have this faster purely acoustic cycle which sometimes is in phase, sometimes is not, and you have this dispersion relation which sets the global phase of the system, and sometimes this one is helps and sometimes does not. So what you can say is that if the two efficiency, so the acoustic cycle is always stable, if the two efficiencies, the sum of the two efficiencies is smaller than one, you're guaranteed that the flow will be stable. If the difference is larger than one, you're guaranteed that it will be unstable. But in between, depending on geometrical factors, on how the the acoustic time scale manages to help or not the be an integral number compared to the advective time scale, it can help or not. And this is the reason why you have scattered growth rates. And so in this 2002 paper, you had a factor, I don't know, maybe 100 between the, no, maybe 50, between the advective and the acoustic timescales. So you had many different modes, and for this, for example, this L equal one is this curve L equal one. These are all the harmonics of the L equal one mode. Between this growth rate and this growth rate, the only difference is the influence of the acoustic cycle. So this leads you to expect a high sensitivity to geometrical factors.
Well, when you said that maybe John Blunden would do, and other people would do, would check out this distribution of eigenvalues over here, that meant in a calculation with more dimensions and a more macroscopic calculation to see if you could identify these particular low modes and their early time result. Does that mean just the slides again?
In the case of, so if you're asking how to find out what is the mechanism in John's calculation?
He was doing a calculation with a fixed gamma, right? He was doing
Yeah, it's very similar.
But in a big three-dimensional stuff going in every direction.
Yeah, when you have a numerical simulation, the problem is that you have access only to one, maybe two eigenmodes, the leading ones. So you have the leading L equal one, the leading L equal two, but so you cannot. You don't have a full eigenspectrum. To me, there are two ways to find out the mechanism at work in John simulation. One is to make the stability analysis as my student did and recognize on the eigenspectrum this kind of scattering of growth rates due to the acoustic cycle, but this is an indirect proof, but this is something he obtained. He could see this kind of scattering, but more analysis is required to be really conclusive. But the easiest way to me would be that, for example, John does his calculation again with a different value of gamma, such that the advective and acoustic timescales become different by a factor 10 or 50, and then it will be no longer possible to he can follow continuously and see if his growth rates scale as an acoustic timescale or if they scale as a with velocity. So this is my conclusion. So I hope this very simple toy model gave you some hints about why advective acoustic cycles lead to low frequency, low order, transverse instability, and that you expect some sensitivity to geometrical parameters due to this contribution of the acoustic cycle. I stress this point because I saw recently in the last paper by Leonard Scheck, the Garching group, that he points out to this surprising sensitivity to initial conditions for the same model. He gets four different outputs just by varying the seed perturbations. So such. I wouldn't say it's a proof of the existence, but it's an indirect consequence of the advective this kind of instability, which are influenced by acoustic waves. This kind of toy model can be, I think, a useful benchmark test for numerical simulations to test the effect of numerical viscosity, and also to test, for example, the effect of boundary conditions, because sometimes you're not careful enough and you don't realize that your boundary condition produces an efficient acoustic feedback. Concerning the core colas problem, I had warned you that I wouldn't that I would be quite far from the realistic simulations, so you're not disappointed. So I am aware that these toy models are different from core collapse simulations from the point of view of gravity, geometry, heating, cooling, photodissociation at the shock, and many other ingredients. And discussing all of them in detail and identifying the relevance of this toy model in realistic simulations is some ongoing work I'm doing with the Garching group. Okay, thank you then.
Well, I do want to come back to viscosity of a non-numerical kind and to the general question of whether the Burroughs thing, which I can't reconstruct, whether there one can reasonably adduce a link between this and that. But first, the viscosity. Yeah, I just went into a region where I thought something would happen. You get helium and protons and neutrons and the helium fraction, very sensitive function of temperature. And so when you do a little compression on this, adiabatic compression, there's a lot of change of...
Which region of the flow are you talking of?
Oh, well, I just picked a random number that I asked Chris if that's all right. And it's I took 10 to the 10th. Density and a temperature of one or two MeV.
At which radius?
What?
At which radius in the flow?
Well, I told you what the conditions would be. That's what he recommended as right under the shock. But you know that can vary all over the place. Just let me state the conclusion because it'd be some answer for any domain you take. And in there, if I looked at the real transition region where you're moving rapidly from one composition to another, you understand when you do a little adiabatic compression and heats it, then there's cooling from neutrino emission at known rates. And the cooling time is a few milliseconds.
You're talking of a region which is much further below what I'm talking of. It's completely unrelated.
Right.
This what you're talking of is a complicated physics happening near the neutrino sphere, and
near the neutrino sphere, but let it pass.
All I'm talking of is in this very high region, like between the shock and 0.3, the radius of the shock. So, if there are some viscous effects, they must be incorporated. They should be incorporated, but from what these specialists, this to me, like people like Adam or Thomas, are to me the specialists of nuclear physics, I am in a region where the flow is invisible.
When you stipulate this, and I go on to my point. I am allowed to state my conclusion, though, which is huge viscosity damping in one cycle in that one little region, okay? But we have Adam here saying, oh, this is now all acoustic. I mean, it's a movie with stuff flowing all over the place. It is a solution of numerical hydrodynamics. He would say that whatever I'm talking about is included out here because if you do things correctly, if you use the right equation of state and your neutrino physics is done totally properly, you will automatically get the back reaction and the cooling on the pressure and the damping of the wave. I suppose, but what I call a disjunction is where he takes this complicated thing, which may or may not, in my unhumble opinion, be correct on the microphysical level, and produces these swirls of stuff, and says in the introduction that's the suddenly this is acoustical rather than something else, and I didn't understand in what sense it was acoustical. So can you just say, generally, how do you recognize in the big simulations of the supposed real case, how you recognize an acoustical contribution from that that's separate from convection and whatever else?
I cannot tell you what Adam did. Didn't investigate his simulations. Maybe to clarify things, I can say that in Adam's explosion mechanism, there is a kind of SASI, whatever the mechanism is, oscillation. There is some global oscillation at, I don't remember, 20 or 200 milliseconds oscillation, which is this global mode, and then 20 milliseconds, right? 20?
She doesn't get it until later, so at least 200 milliseconds.
Yeah.
I mean, the model he was showing was at 1 second.
Yeah, so you have this global oscillation, and
you didn't see five little periodic oscillations, right? It was
Yes, you did.
Okay, I wasn't looking. Right.
Yes, and then this oscillation becomes nonlinear. So up to this point, I think Adam and John and Thomas agree, but then when it becomes nonlinear, you have huge downflows. The one responsible for the kick in Thomas' simulation.
See the linear region when I looked at this.
Yes, there is, yes. And then non-linearly, it will excite, and that's the more difficult thing to understand, because it's a non-linear excitation of some high-frequency G-modes in the neutron star. So how efficiently can a non-linear advocative acoustic instability excite some G-modes? So that's a very difficult question to address. And then how efficiently does a G-mode is damped by leaking by emitting acoustic waves is a second difficult question, which is a linear one then, because everything happens at the frequency of the G-mode. But then estimating the rate of leakage and how well you must resolve numerically the boundary between the neutron star and the exterior to estimate properly this rate. This is another separate issue which deserves some checks. And Adam is aware of that and agrees with the need to check these things. But there are really three problems. One is the advective acoustic cycle, or SASI, whatever. Then excitation of G-modes. The first problem, and then last problem, efficiency of leakage.
These G modes are down in the real core.
Yes, and it's in this part, I think, in this inner region, that I'm sure you have plenty of things to check, but not in the first part. The first part is safely inviscid. Well, hopefully.
So one thing I wasn't sure of was, could you make the connection between your toy model and the numerical simulations? You have the shock region, and then you have this deceleration or acceleration.
Yes.
Width.
Yes.
Where is that happening in the simulations?
So this is a region. This is a region. In the simulations of Leonard, we see a sharp velocity decrease, which is not the case in John's simulation, due to cooling. So I don't know in this particular plot, but it's at a radius which is well above the neutrino sphere, and some intermediate radius where you have an efficient, maybe it's just above the neutrino sphere, or
so that's where his comment is valid, is right down there, just above the neutrino sphere. His concern, neutrino sphere is just where is the neutrinos trapped. You're emitting neutrinos all over the place, and that's what he's worried about. And that inner, I thought you were talking about the accretion shock. The accretion shock, I say, you don't have to worry about viscosity. But down where you're seeing the inner part of that convective region, that's all the physics that Ray is worried about goes in and is important. So that's where the equation of state is doing all the weird things as well, the alpha peak and stuff. So if you're actually studying that inner portion, then that's where you have to worry about a lot of the physics.
Okay, so it means
I never
that.
I don't know where I'm at, Chris.
Now, finding out, identifying on the numerical simulation what is the actual value of this. What is the actual value of this gradient region of this coupling region can be done in Leonard's calculation, hoping that he didn't miss important ingredients about the equation of state. But in John's calculation, it's actually more difficult, although he has less ingredients, because because the coupling region is wider. It's the gradients are less pronounced. But I should say that in my isothermal calculation of 2002, the cycle existed, although it was a purely isothermal flow where the gradients had only scaled like R. So having large gradients does not preclude instability.
I was just wondering, besides core collapse supernova, can you suggest other places in astrophysics where this would be useful? Rather than the core collapse problem is never going to be solved. So,
so there are many. There are many. So the first problem is this Bondi Hoyle-Littleton problem, where the instability of the flow can be understood through this instability, which I showed at the beginning. Then you have you have many examples. You have the detonation, the instability of the cellular instability of detonation fronts. So this is something which has been investigated for decades, and there's a French physicist called Clavin who found 2 years ago, or no, maybe 5 years ago, not long ago, that this instability cellular instability of detonation can be understood as an advective acoustic instability. He didn't use these words, but it's the same, between the shock and the region where the chemistry happens, some distance behind the shock. So you have where the energy is produced. So this formalism is happening in this kind of cellular detonation, and his analytical investigation of the instability mechanism is not fully finished. He did it only in the regime of when you push the overdriven, in the regime of overdriven detonation, and the Chapman-Jouguet regime is not solved yet. But to me, it's one of the things which you can address with this kind of mechanism. But
let me rephrase a little bit then. I guess what I was getting at was, okay, suppose the other way around. Suppose I do a simulation, what should I look for which will tell me that this is the instability that is occurring? What?
Because I had another example. how can you recognize the instability?
Well, at least have some, like, you know, Rayleigh-Taylor, and sometimes I can tell if it is a decelerating, say, some, you know, pressure density gradient or something. What can I look for in this?
The first, no. If you have well-separated timescales, if you have well-separated timescales, this instability is happening on the timescale of advection. The growth rate scales like the time it takes for a perturbation to go to a coupling radius, which is not always easy to determine. It's not necessarily the surface of the star; it can be before that. So, but it's advection timescale plus some acoustic feedback, which is usually fast. So by varying the parameters of your simulation, this is the suggestion I gave to John, you should recognize if your time scales like velocity or sound speed.
So I guess even more basic, so I need like something which has like an outer boundary and inner boundary, in there is some kind of feedback going on, and then I need to
Then you can increase the size of the cavity and check if it changes with the travel time, or if it changes with the acoustic time. this is a way to look at it. But you must be careful when doing it, because when you change the size of the cavity, you can easily go from you can easily go since all these modes are disordered, you could change the leading mode. Here, for example, it's the number 4 which is leading, which is the fastest, but by changing the size of the cavity, you could suddenly be dominated by the number 10 or the number 6. So you have to be aware of this kind of behavior when you change parameters of your simulation. This is what makes it intrinsically difficult to analyze, because you have this acoustic, purely acoustic cycle, which sometimes help and sometimes doesn't.
But then you said to set the results from Scheck, where that it's getting very different things depending on the C perturbation. But I guess it always ends up being seeing the L equals 1 mode, right? So I wasn't too clear on what.
It always ends up, you said?
Well, I'm not sure what ends up, what he gets, or what depends on the C perturbations and what doesn't depend on the C perturbations.
In some cases, look. That's one difference between the simulations of John and the simulations of Leonard, is that John always obtained L equal 1 and sometimes a little bit of 2, but it's really focused on 1, whereas Leonard has a broader distribution of shapes. Yes. Yeah. And to me, this is an interpretation, but to me, this is the consequence of the fact that in John simulation, the size of the gradient is more or less adiabatic. So John is in this range of the of the toy model, where it's only the one remaining, because it's the one which allows for the highest frequencies below the cutoff. Whereas Leonard is more playing in this region, where he is still influenced by other modes. I think you can even make statistics of if we had a better handle on the parameters of the of this coupling region, you could vary things and make some statistics and say in which fraction of simulation you would expect L equal 2, L equal 3, maybe you can even imagine L equal 4. You could play with it.
Okay. So that's it.